Well, at this time, I would like to express my own thanks to Mike Shimei for his excellent presentation. Does anybody have any questions they would like to ask? Yes, Paul.
It seems when you described the test and you showed us a very fancy machine, the architect machine. But what happens when it comes out of that? Isn't there someone that actually sits down with and peers through a microscope to look at cancer cells, cancer growth, whatever? I mean, the machine doesn't do it all, right?
No.
So you didn't tell us about, the technician. What does the technician actually do after the machine's finished with the setup and the spinning and probing and so forth?
That's a good question. What I mentioned before was that in the lab, there's five areas in the lab: chemistry, metallurgy, blood bank. They all do different types of tests. For example, in hematology, that's the type of lab that would be doing hemoglobins, any types of smears to see if you have, generally speaking, leukemias, that kind of thing. In microbiology, that's the lab that does assessment of bacteria, what kind of bacteria are present. In our lab, chemistry, we do tests like PSA, glucose, and cholesterol, that kind of thing. What you're discussing there is more assessments that would be done by John Shrigley, who will be coming here, I understand, which is done by a pathologist. They are the people who would be looking at that type of test. So, for example, if you have a biopsy done and a test done, it goes to one lab, but it goes to pathology here, and they'll look under the microscope to assess what the cells look like, if you've got any abnormal cells, and your blood specimen would go to chemistry. So when we do in chemistry, we're just taking your blood and testing your blood only. And what you're discussing about, and it's a good question, is something that's actually a piece of your body, for lack of a better term, is taken from you and processed and looked at under a microscope by a pathologist. And it's important for you to understand that that particular test, that particular examination is done by a physician. And they are the people who will, that the lab technologist would prepare that specimen on the slide and put the proper stains on and that sort of thing. But it's the pathologist who would look at it and give his professional opinion as to what he sees. Yes.
What's the chances of the security of making sure that the test that went in, that's the one that comes back?
On the instrument from the computer?
Yeah, like if I have one sent in, is it mine that comes back, or?
Yep.
You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, and I guess Punch Imlach said that there's only two things certain in life, and death and taxes, and but he coached the Maple Leafs, and I'm not a Maple Leaf fan, so I don't prescribe to what he said. But no, that's a good question. What we do is, it's interesting. I'm going to answer your question. Just bear with me for one second. That when the presentation is made like this, people who aren't familiar with how labs run, they see these big instruments and they think everybody just pushes a button and we go on our way. But in the background, there's a whole bunch of other things that are done to ensure that the question you brought up is addressed. We have a lot of external bodies that come in and assess our ability to do the test. We have bodies, external bodies from the province of Ontario and from the College of American Pathologists in the United States. We're one of the few labs that are accredited with them. One of the things we have to do is this very issue that you brought up, and we do on a regular basis. We actually go into, take that piece of paper that has your result on it, and then go into our computer and call up your file and say, "Is that PSA? That PSA?" And we do that on a regular basis. On top of that, what we do in our lab is that we'll randomly take patients on a regular basis on each of the instruments that we run, and we may have taken your specimen that day just randomly, and we'll run it twice to see if we get the same result. And we have ranges that we have right now that says, you know, if we take your specimen, it's 1.5 and 1.6, that's terrific. But if it's 1.5 and we got a 10, we have a problem.
I had 4 questions,
Jack. Is that good or is that bad?
In your presentation.
Okay.
Yeah. The last time I had my PSA taken, I was offered an additional test which designated the free and complex. You kind of indicated that up there. I understand this test is quite common in the United States. Do you recommend getting the free and complex broken down, or does it make any difference? What is the complex bad and the free is good, or vice versa?
Well, right now, again, this is something that the physician would decide. I'm not the type of healthcare professional who prescribes testing procedures. I can just tell you what my field, the opinion in my field is as far as lab people are concerned. As I said to you before, we do about 600 PSAs a day, and out of that, 5% have this free test done. It's not a test right now that is very popular for two reasons. One, it's cost you money, and if we have everybody having a total PSA done, having the free, it would cost you more money, and quite frankly, most people would object to that. And the second thing is, the jury is still out as to its usefulness right now. Certainly, for example, this free ratio of free to total is of no use if the total PSA is less than 2.
Okay, my other question was, what's the acceptable PSA number now? It's gone up and down.
Yeah, it's age related. Okay. So, generally speaking, it's the same in most labs. The younger you are, the lower the range is, and I believe I think above 50, anything above 4 is considered to be abnormal. I don't have the numbers at the tip of my tongue, but I think at the lower end, around 30 is less than 2.5, something like that. But it's all age related.
Okay. The other question was, because I had a very low PSA, but I still had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Like,
well, that's
is
a, it, that's
is
another.
Not accurate.
No. It the issue. It's that's a good question because again, and I don't mean to be. I'm not trying to be comical here about this thing about there's nothing certain in life except death and taxes, and there really isn't. There's no test that you can do and say if I do this test unequivocally, 100% sure I have the disease or I don't have the disease. And when a patient comes into a physician, there's a number of things that are used to diagnose you. Among them, a PSA test. Among them, a digital rectal examination. Among them, your age. That kind of thing. So it's not that it's not a specific test, but it's one more piece of the puzzle that's used to reach a diagnosis. And I want to give you an example. In Barrie, when I started there in the late 80s, we started doing this test. We had a young urologist who really wanted these tests on board, and so did I, because I felt it was a good thing to start. And it wasn't uncommon for us to say a patient would come in and the urologist had a digital rectal examination on the patient, couldn't find any abnormality, but the PSA was elevated. Why, I don't know. But it's important to understand that just because the PSA is normal or just because the PSA is elevated, you have to put that in proper context. Yes, sir. Well, again, it's getting outside the realm of my expertise, but no, I wouldn't agree with that. Certainly, Dr. Schrigler will probably be able to, it's a question you should probably pose to him. But I know that that's not true. And that's what we're actually, one of the reasons, getting back to this gentleman's question here about the free PSA, that was one of initially the attractive features was, can we do would a free PSA diminish the number of biopsies we would have to do? And again, as I said, the jury's still out on that. But you know, you should bring that up to Dr. Schrigley when he's here. Another fellow in CML had a question, or the former man from CML.
Mike, just one question. It was possibly an answer to a previously asked question. You are on the barcode system, are you not? Like the barcode from the requisition,
right,
to the barcode to the tube. Your specimen never leaves that specific tube with your barcode on it from start to finish. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's all I mean.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, I'd just like to make a comment in response to Malcolm's statement. You know, what happens if your PSA test result takes a wander? Well, it's incumbent upon you to, when you go visit your physician, make sure that he does in fact have your result in your file. Unfortunately, with a popular name, I won't say common, a popular name like Smith, and an I Smith at that, one time when I went to my doctor.
Your specimen never leaves that Pacific tube with your barcode on it from start to finish, is that correct?
Correct.
That's all I mean.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, I'd just like to make a comment in response to Malcolm's statement. You know, what happens if your PSA test result takes a wander? Well, it's incumbent upon you to, when you go visit your physician, make sure that he does in fact have your result in your file. Unfortunately, with a popular name, I won't say common, a popular name like Smith, and an I Smith at that, one time when I went to my doctor and said, well, how was my PSA this time? Flicks through the file and says, oh, 1.7. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, last time it was 0.0, less than 0.05. Hang on a minute, calls up the secretary. Whoops, we got the wrong I. Smith. So be warned.
Go ahead, Miss. Sorry.
Could you explain, please, the testing that happens after the prostate is removed, and then you do the PSA testing afterwards? How often should, I know it happens like I think every 3 months or something, but how is that different, or why are you doing that? Just clarify that a little bit if you don't mind.
Well, again, I'm giving you my opinion as a lab person and not as a physician. It's important you understand that. But based on the procedure that was performed, getting back to what we do PSA for, is to monitor disease or treatment. If a patient has a procedure performed, the PSA is used to assess reoccurrence, if there is any reoccurrence. Go ahead. I don't think I answered your question. I'm not sure I will be able to, but go ahead anyways.
I'm just trying to understand this because this is the tricky part. So after it's removed, you're not looking to see whether there are any cells left from the prostate that were there before, or are you looking to see whether there are new cells somehow?
Well, again, I'm assuming you mean a radical prostatectomy.
Yes.
And again, I'm just giving my opinion as a scientist here, not as a physician, because I want to make sure, I don't want to overstep my bounds, but the thought process involved was, did we take everything out that needed to be taken out? And if we did, the PSA shouldn't rise.
Okay, and one more question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there should be no food eaten for 6 to 8 hours,
mm-hmm,
or something.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you have eaten? Does,
well,
that change it? Or?
No, it doesn't. It's this is a technical issue. We have the test we do has an antigen and an antibody. The antigen is the thing you're looking for, in this case PSA, and we have an antibody that's specific for that PSA, and when those two things come together, then we can do that chemiluminescence thing. But triglycerides are clumpy stuff, and if you take the exaggerated example that you've had a Big Mac, you know, some French fries, and a donut, and then you walk into the specimen collection center and you have your blood drawn, I'm telling you that the gentleman next to you in the white shirt, sweater, that's what your top part will look like. It's milky. And you can't see it, but it's just clumpy stuff. And what happens is that antigen, which is PSA, and that antibody, which is trying to get at it, can't get at it because all this stuff is in the middle. And if you were fasting, that wouldn't be there, unless you have some other abnormalities, but most people it isn't. So it's just to prevent that type of thing, because a lot of times we may get an error on our instrument. We have criteria for repeating results, and we do it again, and we can't get anywhere near the result we should be getting. We take the specimen out of the instrument and look at it and say, oh, it's milky, and that's why. And we would say to the physician, you know, suggest you repeat it. So it's nothing. It's just a technical issue, and it really affects a lot of tests as well.
After radical surgery, you mentioned wait 6 weeks before you have another PSA done. My doctor decided to wait 3 months. Was that overcautious? Just more waiting.
No, I guess more waiting. The issue is, in my interpretation of that, is that if it came back and your PSA was not detected or extremely low, that would be a good sign after 6 weeks. But if it came back and it was still elevated, in all likelihood, you'd have to come back in another 2 or 3 months to have it done again. Yes? I don't know who I'm looking at here, sorry.
I am used to hearing PSA value from up to 10.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I heard a value 2,000. Is it possible to have a 2,000?
I think anything's possible. I haven't personally seen them 2,000, but I've certainly seen them approaching that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we are so used to a value from 0 to 10.
Right.
That's how we evaluate it. And all of a sudden, a friend came to me and said, I cannot think really, because my PSA now is 200. Yeah, because he didn't want to have any treatment, just herbal and all this. In fact, if I subjected myself to radical prostatectomy, it is because of him. Because my case was indeterminate. And the doctor said, you can wait. But when I heard him talk to me, he said, I didn't see you for 2 weeks. And he said, I had an operation. Well, I was taken to the hospital because they found that I had a leak in my bulb. But I said, and what happened? They cannot operate me. Why? And I know that he told me that his case is the same as me, indeterminate. And he said, you know, they cannot operate me because they found out that my prostate. What's your PSA? I asked. And he looked down and was very, very sad because his PSA is 200. Later on, I found somebody with 2,000, and he lived for more than 20 years. That's why I'm wondering. Yeah. I ask you that question.
I've never seen him that high, but in those cases, it's interesting. Those types of specimens would get more TLC than yours if it's around 10, because it's an anomaly. And then we would be doing it and repeating on different, send it to different labs. So, yes, sir. I'm sorry, this gentleman here. Sorry, go ahead.
Am I waiting for the mic?
I have no choice.
Just a concern now. Before I came here today, I went for my PSA test, and I phoned the lab that, you know, should I fasten or not? And they told me, no, you just come in. You don't need no appointment. You don't need to be fastened. Now I heard that, you know, I shouldn't have eaten something. And the second one is, you said, you know, the rigorous exercise or rigorous, you know, to go on the treadmill or bicycle. Or I spent 2 hours in the gym today. Nobody told me not to do that.
No,
I'm concerned.
Specifically with bicycle, I think, because you're sitting on the seat and you're bicycling and rigorous exercise, not so much exercise in general, but specifically bicycling. That's the issue here. The other thing is, the thing about fasting is something that I, in my own experience, I try to inform people about. And, you know, if it's not an issue with you, it may not be an issue with you, but I can guarantee you as I said, and I'm not exaggerating, that you know, people come in and say, I'm fasting, and you take their specimen, and it's white as milk. It's just what I'm trying to suggest to you is that, you know, we're trying to provide the best result and the best information for your physician so he can make an informed decision. And if we come back and the thing is like your specimen is lipemic, you know, we put that result out and it comes back at comes back at 8 and you've been running at 3.5. You know, he's just going to make you go back and take that specimen again. And that's what I'm trying to get at, and, you know, giving the best result to you as possible. And generally speaking, fasting specimens, generally speaking, are the specimen of choice. There's some tests that you absolutely have to be fasting. Glucose and cholesterol are two of them. But as a rule of thumb, if you're going to have your blood taken for whatever reason, you know, a fasting specimen is the specimen of choice, just from a purely analytical point of view.
There is one of the questions up there when you're saying these two things can affect your PSA, whether it goes up or down, and they were kind of technical words. What would they be in layman's terms? What would you have to take?
Well, it's called cyclophosphamide. I don't know what the common name is. And methotrexate is another one. I'm not sure what the name is on the bottle. I can't give you that information.
Well, what would they be for?
They're a chemotherapy medication. Thank
you. Okay, that's
yeah.
All.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
didn't clarify
you.
That.
Yeah.
I want to add one thing because it was brought up. I didn't want to interrupt people's questions. In our laboratory, we keep specimens for 7 days. I know that most of the time this won't occur, but if there is ever instances where your physician is questioning your results and it's within 7 days, certainly in our laboratory, if it's within 7 days, we still have that specimen. And I think the gentleman I was mentioning here, his PSA had gone up, spiked up a couple of nanograms and came back down. You know, we have those specimens around, and it is not a problem for us if we're requested by our physician to say, do you still have that specimen available? Could you redo that PSA? Can you check it again? Rather than having you come in and have another sample taken. So we keep our specimens for 7 days.
Hi, I just had one comment was with respect to the fasting. You're probably not aware, most people in the room were informed by the hospital at the only time for free testing of the PSA is between 2 and 4 in the afternoon.
Say that again?
At the local hospital, the only time that they will test the PSA free, no cost to us, is between 2 and 4 in the afternoon.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That's probably where the root of that thing is. But I have another basic question, and that is, what are the units of PSA?
Nanograms.
Units of measurement.
Nanograms per mil. Nanogram is 1 gram divided by 10, 9 zeros.
1,000 million.
That's right.
Am I allowed to ask questions as well?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, the question I had was, is there a statewide or province-wide cross-correlation program to calibrate the machines, and how is that done?
And that's a good question.
And what kind of repeatability can you get across the board?
The first part, there is not in Canada, but an organization that an international organization that has taken this upon themselves to standardize PSA testing, because this is an issue. Essentially, when an instrument does a test, it has a calibrator, a standard, and we assign a number to that. And when we do your test, it's all referenced to that number. And the question is that calibrator, is that standard the same at William Osler? Is it the same at St. Michael's? Is it the same at Dynacare? And there is an international group looking at that right now. Reproducibility. In our laboratory, I'm trying to quickly get that information in my mind. But certainly the units or the terms we use are percent. And for the layman, that's kind of difficult to understand. The way I look at it is when I give you a result, I'm telling you that our instrument can tell the difference between a 2 and a 5. Our instrument can tell the difference between a 5 and a 6. So if you have a result that's 4 nanograms, it's not 10 and it's not 1. And that's the best way for me to explain it to you without getting into too much of the statistics involved. And essentially that's part of quality control. What can I tell the difference from? If I can't tell the difference between a 2.1 and a 2.2. I can't tell the difference between a 0.7 and a 0.8. That's just not possible on any of the instrumentation we have right now. But I can tell the difference between a 0.7 and a 2.5.
Every now and then, when my doctor is requesting for a PSA determination, he always includes the free PSA. What is the role of free PSA in the evaluation of my the result that they gave me?
Yeah, as I said before, the whole incentive to do free PSA was to try to address the number of biopsies that were being done. You know, in any invasive procedure, if a patient doesn't have to have an invasive procedure, that's the name of the game, that's the goal. And so free PSA was thought to be a test that we could do instead of a biopsy. Would a free PSA give us the same information as a biopsy? So that's why it's being ordered. And two things about the free PSA. One is that it's not a good test if your total PSA is less than 2 nanograms per ml. So if you have a PSA that's 1.5, then a free PSA is probably not a good test to use, because it, for all intents and purposes, gives you little information. If your PSA is greater than 2, and your ratio is greater than 0.2, then that's a good prognosis. If it's less than 0.1, that's a poor prognosis.
You've probably answered this question in your dialogue, but how actually are the numbers arrived at? I mean, we've heard of cases of 700 PSA, and apparently this gentleman did not have cancer. 10 PSA, and he did. How is the actual number arrived at?
Remember when I was describing the way the test is done, there's an antigen and an antibody. Again, the antigen is the PSA. That's the thing we're trying to test, and the antibody is the stuff we have in the reagent of the instrument. It's not uncommon. It doesn't happen frequently, but it does happen. That antibodies sometimes can't tell the difference between things they think they're seeing, things like PSA, and something that looks like PSA. So for example, if it sees PSA and another protein, it may think it's the same and bind it. And if it binds it, it starts increasing the result that will be determined. So this is called the non-specific binding. And this happens periodically. And it's just something inherent in the test. It doesn't happen frequently, but it does happen. And it's the fact that the antibody can't tell the difference between PSA and this thing over here. It assumes it's PSA, and we test it as PSA. Yes, sir.
In your lab, I would assume that the instruments are calibrated as to the bioluminescence, which in turn gives you the numbers, like the intensity of the light would represent the different numbers.
Mm-hmm.
How often are these instruments calibrated in order to have a uniform result over the long run?
Instruments are calibrated under two circumstances. One is the reagent we purchase bulk lot numbers, so we'll purchase a whole bunch of reagents with a certain lot number. If we get a new lot number in, that's a reason to calibrate, and we will recalibrate the instrument. The second reason we calibrate is the quality control material we run is unacceptable. Quality control material simply means what the word says. It's monitoring the quality of the results that we're determining. We have a specimen. We know what the PSA is in that from determining over a number of determinations, and we set up a range. When we run the quality control, if it's inside that range, we know the results that we're providing to you are correct or valid. If they are outside that range, we don't report at all and go back and troubleshoot. So to answer your question, we calibrate when we get new lot numbers of reagent, when our quality control indicates that we need to recalibrate.
That would indicate the quality control is done on the actual amount of chemicals that are being used, the control chemical versus the test chemical. But what about the quality control on the actual electronic instrument, which measures the amount of light coming off the bioluminescence?
Well, that's excuse me. That's again part of the whole the quality control procedure. What we are assuming is that this material, which is like human blood, if we can get that result, we then conclude that the results we're doing on our patients are valid. If we have issues where the light source on the instrument or maybe the pipetting of the instrument has gone off, then that would be reflected in our quality control result as well. And if we, you know, for example, in what you're suggesting here, if the light source is deteriorating, we would see this downward trend of our QC, and we monitor the QC on a daily basis. So if we saw that, we would start doing our troubleshooting. And because of the workload we do at Dynacare, and because of the fact that and this particular instrument is the worldwide, we produce the most number of tests on it, the company who we use gives us a lot of good service, and virtually the serviceman is in there on a regular basis. And if we have any issues, they're addressed. But the simple answer to the question is the quality control. The name of the game is we have a sample that we treat exactly like we treat your specimen. It's gone. It gets put on randomly, and we have criteria that we have to meet. If we don't meet, there's no results reported.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I think after this time, again, I'd like to thank Mike for... Michael, you have one last chance because I'm sure everybody is...
my question is coming back to this calibration. Now, is this calibration procedure proactive or retroactive? And the second question is, when you do the calibration, do you calibrate at all the three different extremes or just in the midpoints?
No. Let me ask your second question first. We have a range of concentrations, and I don't have this information, but just let's assume it's on the order of 0 nanograms to 100 nanograms. So we have calibrators all through that. So we run those calibrators as patients and plot them on essentially on a graph electronically. So it's not just 1 or 2 points. First question again, you want to repeat that?
Well, you can do calibration in two ways. One is you have a periodic proactive program to maintain it, or you could wait for things to start showing a signal of degradation and then go in and fix it.
Yeah, one of the problems with variability on the results, strangely enough, is over calibrating, and you can get to a point, and not only in this test but in other tests, where every time you have an issue or you think you have an issue, you recalibrate, and it's not really the calibration that's the issue. So we don't. I can probably best answer it and say that we do the calibrations proactively to avoid any issues, in this case, differences in lot numbers might present, or issues that we have with changes in quality control material. Statistically, if you do a lot of if you do over quality control, you're going to get results that are outside this range purely by chance. 1 in 20 purely by chance would be outside that range, and it wouldn't be clinically relevant.
No more questions. Thank you very much again, Mike, for your presentation, and we'll break for coffee. Thank you.